This is the Living Homegrown Podcast, episode number 91.
Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast, where it's all about how to live farm fresh without the farm. To help guide the way to a more flavorful and sustainable lifestyle is your host, national PBS TV producer and canning expert, Teresa Lowe.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Lowe, and this podcast is where we talk about living farm fresh without the farm. And that means that we talk about things like preserving the harvest, small space food growing, and other simple ways that you can live a more sustainable lifestyle. As always, if you want to dive deep into any of the topics that I cover on the show or learn about my online canning academy, just visit my website, livinghomegrown.com. Today's episode is all about the harvest. Now, I don't mean that we're going to talk about how you harvest food or when you harvest food. I'm talking about a new book that just came out called Harvest, and we're going to talk about all the different things that you can harvest from your garden and why you would want to. Now, I'm bringing on a guest that I've had on before. It's Stephanie Bittner. She is the co-author of the new book, Harvest. And by the way, the subtitle of this book is Unexpected Projects Using 47 Extraordinary Garden Plants. And Stephanie was on the show before. She came on and was on episode 75, which was all about how to create an epic edible garden. Now, if you didn't listen to that show or you're not familiar with Stephanie, she is the owner of Homestead Design Collective, which is a landscape design firm up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And what they're known for is creating beautiful gardens that provide a harvest. Now, that harvest can be food or that harvest can be flowers. There's all different parts of the plants that are usable. And her focus or her team's focus is to create unique, sophisticated gardens that can also utilize the productiveness of the plants. And she is, of course, an organic gardener, and she has written another book called The Beautiful Edible Garden, and that book was what we were talking about when she was on before. Now, Homestead Design Collective will not only design gardens and install them, but they also do a full service maintenance, organic maintenance of different gardens. They even will help people with setting up beekeeping, floristry, and composting with their gardens. So as you can imagine, Stephanie is pretty well known in the California area, but she's also nationally known because some of her gardens have been featured in many different magazines. And just recently, she and her team designed the new test gardens for Sunset magazine. And there was a whole spread in the October 2016 issue of the gardens that they designed. And they're completely edible and absolutely gorgeous. But she's also been featured in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Los Angeles Times, Better Homes and Gardens. She's just been featured all over the place. So it's a real honor to have her come back and talk about this new book. Now, the reason I wanted her to come back is not just because I think she's awesome, which she is, but because this book is right up your alley if you listen to this podcast. In the book, they feature 47 different and more unusual plants, maybe not, you know, the typical edible plants, but they go into some of the more unusual ones. And they show you or talk about how you can use everything from the petals to the leaves to the roots and the seeds, not just the fruit of these plants. And that's what I loved. But I also love how absolutely beautiful the book is. The photography is exquisite. So I want you to remember that, as always, I will have all the information in the show notes for this episode of everything that Stephanie talks about, as well as her website, links to books, and there is a special recipe that she is sharing from the book that you can get as a PDF download in the show notes. All you have to do to get the show notes is go to livinghomegrown.com/91, and everything will be there for you. So let me bring on Stephanie Bittner, and we're going to talk all about harvest. Hey, Stephanie, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this is going to be great because you've been on the show before. You were on episode 75. And when you were on, we were talking about this book, Harvest, but it hadn't come out yet. Now I've actually had it in my hands and I love it. And I just can't wait for you to share more information about it with the listeners because it's right up their alley.
I'm really excited to share it as well.
Perfect. Well, I guess we should start in case someone hasn't ever heard the first episode that you were on, episode 75. Why don't we start with you telling everybody what it is that you do?
Sure. So I co-own a business called Homestead Design Collective, and we're located in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we specialize in creating very beautiful, but also highly productive edible landscapes. And that does not mean we're putting farms in people's front yards. Although if someone wanted to go there, I'd be happy to do it. But it really is focusing on including plants that give you harvest that are also very functional and very beautiful. So why have a fruitless plum as your focal point front yard tree? Why not include a focal point tree that gives you a harvest of some sort? And we also recently designed the new gardens for Sunset Magazine. And my co-owner and I have both written multiple books on gardening and floral arts.
Yes. And while we're talking about the Sunset Gardens, we talked about that a lot in episode 75. We'll be sure to have a link in the show notes to some of the photographs of that garden. But you do a really incredible job of not just making a landscape beautiful, but making it really productive and functional. A garden can be so much more than just pretty. And when you talk about harvest, you're not just talking about harvesting fruits and vegetables. You're also talking about flowers and fragrance and useful plants. And is that actually what made you want to do this book, Harvest?
It is. You know, when I think about how I live in a garden and the gardens that we create, it really is about creating a space that gives back to you. Gardens take resources. And not only of, you know, money to create and also water to help them grow, but also the resource of our time. So the idea behind having a harvestable garden is that as you give to your garden, you're able to also have a garden that gives back to you. And of course, that includes our fruits and vegetables, but it also includes herbs, our cut flowers, and other aspects of the plants to really bring into your homes on a weekly basis and really enjoy them.
Yeah, and you cover in this book not just the fruit of a plant, but you cover the roots and the leaves and the flowers. It's nose to tail. It's like the whole, you know, the whole plant. And that's what's so awesome. So one of the things I noticed when you did the book was that it's definitely been photographed. The photographs are absolutely gorgeous, by the way. I love the pictures, but it was definitely photographed in real time. And so one of the questions I've been wanting to ask you was, did you have to write the book over an entire season or entire year in the garden?
So the book actually was a complete labor of love and took 2 years to produce. So we shot every single plant in its moment of harvest and then harvested it and then did the project all within that moment. So the book is actually organized as you're harvesting through the season, and the plants are not listed in order of trees, shrubs, ground cover, that kind of a thing. It's actually listed in order of that moment of harvest. So if you flip through the book, you can actually even see the change of light happening through the photos.
The idea of the way you did the timing is really cool. You know, most books would just say summer, spring, winter, fall. And you had a different kind of a take. You had three main seasons in the book. Can you explain that?
Sure. The book is separated by the gardening terms early, mid, and late. And that really is so that folks who live anywhere can jump into the book where that season begins. So for instance, I happen to live in Northern California. My early season is much earlier than someone who lives in Minnesota. And so for me, I might be harvesting those plants in February, but early might begin for someone who lives in Minnesota in May. It really doesn't matter the month. I didn't want to say you harvest this in February or you harvest this in early spring. It was really more to find these seasons in those gardening terms.
I thought that was so brilliant because that's exactly one of the problems that people have with some of the books when they say spring. Well, spring for me would definitely be different for someone in another part of the country. So I loved that. And that is when you're planting fruit trees, for example, there are early fruit trees and there are late fruit trees. So that was a great, that was really brilliant the way you did that. I love it.
The idea is that you want to have a good variety of things that give you an early, mid, and late harvest because we're gardening with these plants. We're not farming. So we want to, as one plant finishes its season, we want the next one to begin so that we just always have something to go out and harvest from in the garden.
That's so great. Yes. And that's what we want. I mean, we want to have every available space giving us something at some time in the year. The other thing that you use in the book are the USDA hardiness zones, hard to say, the hardiness zones. And I think that's very standard for gardeners. But if someone's listening and they have never gardened before and they're just getting started, could you explain how they could figure out what zone they're in so that they kind of know if you're saying, well, this is a great plant for zone 5 through 7, they don't know what their zone is. How do they figure that out?
Sure. So basically, and I find that a lot of folks think that the U.S. hardiness zones are a little intimidating. And really, all it is a guide to let you know where a plant typically succeeds and does really well. So the first thing to do is you can just I do give the link in the book, but you could just Google U.S. gardening hardiness zones, and there's a map, and you find where you live, and it will actually show you what zone you are. And it is really helpful. Again, someone who lives in zone 3, and those would be folks who live on the U.S.-Canadian border, they have a much colder winter than folks that live in Southern California. So it's really important to know what plants can handle going down to minus 30 degrees and will still come back and be perennial for you in your garden. We did also include a lot of annuals, though, in the book. And every person in the country, no matter where you live, from Alaska to Florida, can grow annuals. So there's definitely a little something for everyone in this book.
Yes. And if someone doesn't know, an annual is something that goes through its entire life cycle in one season. So it sprouts, it grows up, it gives harvest, and then it dies. So that's why it's great, because you don't have to try and keep it alive during winter because it's not supposed to. Here in Southern California, we have a lot of things that are supposed to be annual that end up coming back regularly, but normally in any other part of the country, they would not. So, and perennial is when you have a plant that comes back year after year, it should survive winter. And knowing your zone will determine if you have to put it in a greenhouse to keep it alive so that it doesn't get too cold and it can survive the temperatures. So all of that you have in the book, which is fantastic, about the zones and how to grow and what things grow best in the different zones. And that's just a great foundation for whatever you want to grow. But another thing that you have in the book is a little bit about safety when you're first starting out planting a garden. And this is so important for someone who lives in the city like I do. And we talked about it the last time you were on, and I thought it was really important to mention again. Could you talk just for a minute some of the things that if you're going to be growing food in your backyard and you live in an urban area, some of the things that you should think about as far as food safety?
Sure. I'm a bit obsessed with this topic. So anytime you want to discuss it, the basic principle is that when we choose to grow food in our gardens, we really want to make sure that we're growing it safely. So for so many of us, we're growing food in our gardens because we're concerned about what our food source is. So you want to think about contaminants that are below and above the garden. Below the garden, the number one thing is lead. If you live in the city or an older home, there are very good chances that your home at some point may have been painted with lead paint. It's a super easy test to find out if you have lead in your soil. Typically, it's only within about 18 inches to 2 feet from the structure of your home. So what you do is you do a simple soil test, you locate and you see where that lead is, and then you plant an ornamental plant. You can still harvest from that plant because you can use it for flower arrangements, but you just don't want to eat food that is grown in medium to high levels of lead. Other contaminants could include exposure to pressure-treated wood. Before about 7-10 years ago, all pressure-treated wood was made with arsenic. Arsenic also will sit and contaminate the soil. It doesn't mean that you cannot grow food in your garden. Again, just looking in your garden, and if you know that you have an old fence, and you see that it has a pressure treated post, choose that spot to put an ornamental plant that, again, you can harvest as for flower arrangements, and then go out 2-3 feet from it and then start growing your food producing food. And then above the ground, the number one contaminants tend to be our pets. So creating safe spots for our pets, for them to be able to dig in the garden or use the garden, you know, and then in the front yard, thinking about the fact that you share your front yard with your community. Unless you fence off where your front yard meets the sidewalk, more than likely when people pass by, you should assume that their dogs may use the restroom on that part of your garden. So just don't put anything there that you eat.
Yeah, not a good idea to grow lettuce along the sidewalk.
I cannot agree more.
Great. Okay, good. Well, I wanted to dive into some of the things that you cover in the book, and we're going to mostly talk about some of the edibles, but I did just want to mention that you have a lot of things in the book that you're not talking about edibles, that you talk about other things that you can do. And one of them was lilacs. You even have a recipe for like a hand salve or a cream.
Yeah. So the book is about 47 plants. They all are edible plants. So they're all plants that you can eat. But what we're trying to do is really open everyone's eyes up to this new plant palette, that you can utilize these plants in your landscape. They're incredibly beautiful. You can eat them, but they're harvestable for other things. So with the lilac, a lot of people actually don't realize that lilac blooms are edible. So I would highly encourage you to harvest your lilacs and add some to either top off a baked good or add them to your salad or make a cordial, which would be really fun, or a homemade soda. But the project that we did for the book is actually a flower cream. And it uses the very traditional way of making perfume called enfleurage. I hope I said that correctly. And what it is that you infuse the scent of the lilac blooms into a fat. Now, back in the day in France, they used to use lard. We chose to use coconut oil. So we infuse coconut oil over a period of time. The coconut oil takes in the scent of the lilac, and what you have is this beautiful cream that you can use to moisturize your hands, your elbows. You can use it as a lilac-based perfume. And because it's made out of coconut oil, you can actually also cook with it.
Okay, so that's fantastic. And I think you did open up everybody's eyes to some different uses of the plants. Now, one of the plants that you had in there was a whole section on elderberries. And I was really interested in this because I'm just now planting elderberries at our 1892 farmstead up in Northern California. So I'm just learning about elderberries, about growing elderberries. I definitely know all the wonderful things that you can do with them, or at least some of the things that you can do with them. But I'd love for you to talk first a little bit about growing elderberries.
Well, sure. Elderberries are just a fantastic shrub to have in your landscape. I think they're incredibly beautiful. They're deer resistant, which is always very important for folks. They are also a low water shrub once they're established, and that means that they need regular water for that first year of growth. But once they're established and their roots are pretty deep, they actually can go onto a low water regimen, which is very exciting for folks that live in more drought-stricken areas. They are a plant that also happily lives in full sun to shade. So what that means as well, from a landscaping point of view, is that you can repeat this plant throughout your garden, transitioning from spots that are sunny to partial shade to shade, and use it as a plant that's being repeated. The plants that are in the sun are going to produce a lot more berries than the ones that are in the shade, but they will happily grow. And the foliage of elderberries are actually one of our favorites to add to flower arrangements. So just because you don't have the berries doesn't mean that you can't be harvesting from this plant. A couple things to know about this plant, though. It is one of the very few plants in the book that has some toxicity to it. The flowers, which are a spring harvest, and the berries, which are a fall harvest, are edible and are actually super high in nutrients, antioxidants, the whole works. But the bark and the unripened berries and the foliage are considered toxic. So you do not want to consume them.
Yeah, that's really important. I'm glad you brought that up. So this is important if someone is harvesting the berries, let's say, and they are cutting off the berries on a stem, you can't, you know, just throw the whole thing into something edible, because the stems and the leaves and everything have to be, the berries have to be removed from the plant. Right.
Exactly. And kind of our rule of thumb when we're harvesting the berries is, so first of all, the elderflowers and the elderberries grow in clusters. So you look at the shrub and you have this big cluster of umbels of either flowers or berries. When we're harvesting the berries, we look for a cluster that actually has what I refer to as an elderberry raisin, meaning that some of the berries have actually aged to the point where they're drying out. And that typically has given all the rest of the berries a chance to ripen. So that's kind of my clue, my visual clue, that I can go ahead and harvest that group. Harvesting, taking the berries off the stems are a little tedious, I'm not going to lie. I typically will put on a podcast like this one and listen and start taking them off, but it's really worth it. The elderberry is something that you can't easily get in a grocery store, let's say. It's really one of those special treats that you really grow your own or forage for.
Yes, yes. So you can use even the umbrals and flowers. You could use those in flower arrangements as well. Do they hold up pretty well?
They do. And also, I should say in the book, in talking about utilizing the full plant, some of the plants, we actually include a secondary, you know, we put the point of harvest as actually like a first harvest. So in the book, we're harvesting the flowers to infuse honey. One of my favorite infusions to do with edible flowers is tonic water that makes the most beautiful gin and tonics if you happen to partake in that. And so you could use the flowers in a flower arrangement, but the flowers are so incredible to eat or to infuse with. I would say harvest all the flowers, cut off the stems of that, and then use the foliage in a flower arrangement.
Okay, good point. And I noticed in the book you even mentioned, but don't go crazy with the flowers and then pull them all off and not get any fruit.
Oh, yeah. So the whole thing to keep in mind is... Yeah. If you eat all of your flowers, that means that you will not have a berry harvest. So keeping that in mind, harvest a third of the plant or a half of a plant, depending on how much you like the berries. You kind of have to, it's one of those things as you're living with this plant. You know, what's so great about plants that come back every year, the perennials, is that we live with them. So maybe 1 year you're traveling and you miss the flower harvest. Not a big deal, because you'll have more berries. And then the next year, maybe you harvest half of your flowers. It's really something that you can experiment with each year. And elderberries will become a large shrub. I typically like to keep mine at about 8 feet, but they will happily grow to 12 feet if you let them. So if you want to kind of push your winter pruning, I do this a lot, you know, when you're gardening and not farming, you can kind of get away with this. Sometimes I'll actually let the tree or the shrub go ahead and flower and then do some really deep cuts to kind of then restrict the height so that I'm harvesting and pruning at the same time.
Ah, okay. That's a really good tip. Very good. Why don't you tell everybody, if we had elderflowers and we had them at the ready, how would we make the elderflower honey?
Sure. So it's a pretty simple technique. With any of your edible flowers, when you harvest them, when you inside, I highly recommend that you do not run them underneath a faucet of water, but instead get a small bowl with some cool, cold water, and you simply just dip the flower heads into the water and then take them out. And what you're doing is just loosening any dirt. And we say in the book that it's really important to grow these plants organically. And when you do, what's so wonderful is that you don't have pesticides in your garden. You're not having to wash them to remove pesticides. So you dip your flowers in the cool water and you lay it out on a cool cloth and you just let Mother Nature dry it, let air dry it. Once they're dry, you remove all the blooms and they're small. So again, it's a little tedious, but you just remove the flowers off the stem. It'll probably take you 10, 15 minutes. It's not too bad. And I collect them in a small mason canning jar. Once you do that, you take your honey and you pour the honey in and you just want to cover the flowers. I use a chopstick to actually stir it during this process to release any air bubbles that might collect at the bottom of the jar. You cover the flowers in honey, you seal it, you let it sit for about a week. At that point, you strain out the flowers. And then you have a beautiful infused honey. What's also nice is that you don't want to throw away those honeyed elderflowers. You can actually dry them and then you can throw that into a tea mix.
Okay, fantastic. So what we're doing is we're just infusing the elderflower flavor into the honey. And when we're letting it sit, we just can let it sit on the countertop, right? We don't have to put it in the refrigerator.
Yeah, you know, I usually say a cool, dark place. So a pantry is really great. I just wouldn't leave it in a window where you're getting direct sunlight. But, you know, a cool, dark place is the best place to do it. Sure. And what's great is that you're not only infusing the flavor, you're also infusing the honey with also all of the great properties of the flower, which includes all those antioxidants.
Ah, fantastic. Yes. And honey can sit at room temperature because it's so high sugar. It's actually a preservative. So it's perfectly fine for this to be sitting on the counter. So, okay, that's fantastic. So another thing that you have in the book was the huckleberry. And I'd love to talk about the huckleberry for a few minutes because that's another thing that is kind of unusual. A lot of people don't just run out and put a huckleberry in their front yard, but it's a great plant. Could you talk about that?
It is an evergreen shrub that is highly ornamental. The new growth on the huckleberry is this really beautiful burgundy toned, like bronzy color. And then in the spring, you get flowers. And then you have in the early late, so really in the transition from summer to fall, you have these beautiful small bluish black berries. They're super sweet. They pack a lot of punch in those little berries. And you can do a lot with huckleberries in the landscape. It's the perfect plant to use in transition. If you have a space where you're kind of going for more manicured part of your garden, and then you kind of want to let it go into more of a native natural scape, the huckleberry can be used in both circumstances. And so it's a great transitional plant to use.
Ah, I didn't know that. Now, how big does a huckleberry plant get?
Well, it depends on where you live and also what kind of gardener you are. Here in the Bay Area and in San Francisco, where I live, they're a little bit slower growing than, let's say, if you lived in the Pacific Northwest. I have seen huckleberries 10 feet tall in Oregon, but I can tell you where I live, they do not get that tall. We typically like to keep our huckleberries at about 3 feet and mass them out in large groups. So typically I'm planting them in 25, in groups of 30, and they almost look like a carpet and kind of like a mid-size ground cover, if you want to think of it that way. And so when we do our pruning, we're utilizing the branches in our flower arrangements.
Ah, okay. Wow. 25 plants. You plant 25 plants in one section.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can also do 7. You don't want to plant just one.
Got it.
I mean, huckleberries are definitely a plant that you want to plant in groups of like 3, 5, 7s. I tend to be a bit huckleberry obsessed. So I go for 25 typically.
Okay.
And I think it's a plant that's well worth it. It is also a plant that really supports the wildlife in your garden. You should realize when you grow this plant that you are going to be really lucky if you get half of your berry harvest. It happens to be the favorite of many of the birds that are visiting your garden. I think that's a great thing. Encouraging birds to live and cohabitate with you in your garden is a really important aspect of gardening. So I don't mind that I'm sharing my harvest with the birds that visit my garden. But if you are looking for each single berry, plant those shrubs a little bit closer to your house so that you can really watch when those berries turn ripe.
Good point. Yes. So that you can run out and grab them before the birds do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now in the book, you give a recipe for making a huckleberry shrub, which if someone isn't used to what that means, you don't mean the shrub that is in the garden. It's a drink. So could you tell us?
Yeah.
So could you tell everybody what a shrub is and how we could do that with a huckleberry?
I can. So very similar. You'll see that there's a theme that's happening here in this book. As we're encouraging people to grow these really beautiful, productive plants, we're also trying to teach some skills that are really nice to have when you live with an edible garden. So we're teaching folks to preserve with honey. And then a shrub is simply preserving fruit with vinegar. So back in the day, shrubs were actually an extremely popular method of preserving a fruit harvest. And they've had a really big resurgence lately. And
yes.
So you will see shrubs at very fancy restaurants these days. And they're actually one of my favorite ways to have a really refreshing summer cocktail, non-alcoholic. And also they're very good for you. Anything with vinegar, you're adding lots of good qualities of fermentation into your gut. So it's actually very good for you. It's a great way to preserve your harvest. And it's a fun drink to serve to your guests.
Yes, I love it in the summer too. And I've been doing shrubs for years and years because I've always been an herb gardener and herbs were kind of my gateway to all the other edibles.
Oh, I should say you can do shrubs with herbs too. Sorry.
Yes, yes.
I was thinking about huckleberries and being.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. So yeah, you can preserve with vinegar on any of the edibles, but it's mostly done with fruit. And that's what's really popular right now. But yes, it's so refreshing on a hot, hot summer day to have a shrub. And people kind of turn their nose up at first and say, it's you, because you're putting vinegar in a drink. It's vinegar and water. You could use carbonated water, but it doesn't taste like you're drinking vinegar. It just has a little tangy, fruity. It's kind of even hard to describe. But why don't you tell everyone, how would we make one of these?
Sure. So it's a pretty simple, and again, in the book, we give the recipe, but really you want to think about your ratios. So if you've just harvested 1.5 cups of huckleberries, let's say, you would then use an equal amount of vinegar. I use champagne vinegar with my shrubs only because I like just that lighter tang, as you described it, when it comes to the huckleberry, so that I can really taste the huckleberry. But you can use apple cider vinegar. There's many different types of vinegars, you know, of course, that you can use. But the ratio is 1 cup of the huckleberries to 1 cup of the champagne vinegar, and then also 1.5 cups of organic cane sugar. And again, you're doing an infusion. You, in a small saucepan, you would just bring the sugar and the vinegar to a brief boil. And then you pour the hot vinegar mixture over the berries and you seal them in a jar. You can gently macerate or crush the berries to help release the flavor. And then you're just going to let that sit for 4 to 5 days. I do find that when I make, you know, the time of year that we harvest our huckleberries tends to be a very hot time of year where I live. So it's hard to find a cool, dark place in my house in September. So I have many occasions actually put my shrub at that point into the refrigerator and left it there longer. That's not a traditional way to make a shrub. And Teresa, you may tell me that that's wrong.
No,
but
it's not.
I do find it's hard. Sometimes it's a common sense. Like if you don't have that cool place, mm-hmm. you need to create it.
Yeah.
I just let it sit a little bit longer. And then when you serve it, I use carbonated water. I often will put a nice piece of either lemon verbena or a scented geranium as a garnish. And it really is just such a refreshing drink on a hot fall day.
Yes. And no, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, putting it in the refrigerator. That's totally fine. And the longer it sits, it just gets more of the fruit flavor. So there's no like set time, like, oh my gosh, if you let it go over a certain number of days, it's ruined. You know, it just gets stronger. Yeah.
But it just gets stronger.
Yeah.
And it really is, it's tasting, right? So after the first 4 or 5 days, if you taste it and you feel like you don't have that essence of huckleberry that you want, you just let it sit longer. And just let kind of get the juices flowing and you'll get to the point of taste that you'll like.
Yeah, exactly. And then to make your shrub, you just put a few tablespoons of the vinegar in a glass and fill it up with your sparkling water and ta-da, it's done. It's really easy.
It's really easy.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And you can, like you said, again, in the back of the book, we have a project ingredient list. So over half the plants in this book, you could make a shrub with. But we only, of course, give just the one shrub recipe. But the idea, again, is that you're learning how to make a shrub. And then you do the huckleberry. Maybe next time you want to do a quince shrub or an apricot shrub or a lemon verbena shrub. You know, again, you're just kind of building upon that skill.
Exactly. Perfect. Well, since you mentioned quince, I have to ask you about that because that was the third plant I really wanted you to talk about. Now, I was a little bit familiar with quince because it's my mom's favorite fruit. She always made quince jelly as I grew up. But most of my friends, when I show them a quince, they have no idea. They're like, is it a pear? Is it an apple? You know, it looks so different, but it is actually a really beautiful tree and it's a really fantastic fruit. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what is a quince and how could we grow that?
Sure. So I'm a bit also obsessed with quince. It's one of those trees that really has kind of fallen out of favor. And in gardens, it is something that my grandmother had in her garden. And I would imagine kind of that generation, it was something that was included. The quince is a relative of the apple. And many people actually believe that it was the quince that Eve offered to Adam and actually not an apple. But that is to be debated if you want to. But it's a beautiful tree. The fruit is really knobby and just so beautifully imperfect. And so different looking and so highly fragrant. I cannot say enough about the fragrance of this fruit. When I do my harvest, often when they're ripe, you've got to pick them. So sometimes they'll sit on my counter for, you know, a good week or two before I can get around to making something with them. And my entire kitchen will be filled with the most heavenly scent. I really like the pineapple, the variety of the pineapple quince. It also is the variety of quince that is least likely to get blight. The pineapple variety is not blight resistant completely, but is very easy to manage. So I highly encourage folks to search it out. There's also a fantastic website where you can buy bare root fruit trees all across the country. It's called Trees of Antiquity. And the gentleman who owns this organic heirloom orchard and sells the bare root trees from it grows some of the most beautiful varieties of quince.
Yeah, if you're looking for anything unusual, that is a great place to go. I know I've ordered some trees from him before and they've been top quality and things that I couldn't find anywhere else. One of the things with quince that people don't usually know is one of the more unusual aspects of it is that you really have to cook it to eat it. It's not like an apple that you pick off the tree and then just bite into it because it's rather hard.
And inedible.
Yes. Yes.
It's not just hard. It tastes horrible.
Yes.
If you don't cook it.
Yeah. So you have to cook it. So I think that might be another reason probably why it had fallen out of favor is people don't realize that and they get one and try and bite into it. They're like, this is terrible. What would anyone want with this? But it has really high pectin. And so it works fantastic in jellies and jam making. And a lot of the old fashioned recipes and a lot of people who grew up making jams and jellies know of quince because it would be used just like apples would because they're high in pectin as well. So I know in your book, you have a recipe for quince paste and it's a great thing to serve with like cheese and crackers. It's almost like a jello because it's so firm because it's got so much pectin that it's really, really firm. And so I would love to be able to include in the show notes for this episode where people could go and get that recipe because it would be too hard to talk people through how to make it. But I'd love to be able to include the recipe in the show notes so people could go there and get it.
That would be great. And I will say, you know, quince paste is, in Spain, they call it membrillo, is a traditional complement to a cheese platter. I really, when you follow my recipe or any quince paste recipe, you're making a jelly that is very firm, like you're saying. And if you stop at that point and you actually just cool it off in a square Pyrex container, you can cut from it and cut squares. Or what most folks, you know, what folks will do is they'll, after they've made the jelly, actually dry it out in an oven so that you get that really hard, almost like gelatin-like texture. I happen to really love paste. The paste is more of a jelly so that you have the structure, but you're not eating quince jello, basically. Mm-hmm. So I kind of walk folks through that as far as the different textures and really experimenting with what kind of texture is best for your palate. You don't have to finish it off and make it completely hard. And so again, it's one of those great things when you're growing it yourself or you're making it yourself, you can really experiment with.
Yeah, and go by what texture you prefer. That's fantastic because by not drying it out, it would definitely be more spreadable. And that would be nice. You could, you know, spread it on a cracker better than you could when it's really hard. It's more like you're having a slice of it on a cracker.
Exactly. But it has so much pectin in it. Even if you don't dry it out, when it cools, you can cut it into squares and still slice it.
Yeah.
It's just that it will then become spreadable.
Yeah.
Which I actually think is very nice.
Yeah. But the flavor is incredible. So it, even though it doesn't have fantastic flavor, if you were to try and bite into it off the tree, it does have a fantastic flavor when it's cooked. And that's why people make jelly with it, because it really is delicious.
You know, if I'm making homemade applesauce, I'll typically throw in one quince in with the apples, and it just enhances the flavor of the apples. And it's so beautiful. Of all the jams that I make, and I make a lot of jam, the quince paste is the first thing to go in my house. Everyone from the smallest kid to the oldest, it is the first one they want to eat. And because the flavor is just so unlike other things, it's almost like this garden honeyed sweet flavor. It is so beautiful and is also something that's more unique. We really love it. And I should say also about the tree, one of the reasons why I love to include it in gardens is I think, in my opinion, it is one of the well-behaved fruit trees for a garden. They tend to stay naturally dwarf. And so it's really something that's easy to put by a garden path and know that it's not going to shade out other trees. It is an extremely well-behaved fruit tree.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, because we did plant some quince trees in our heirloom orchard. And I have to say, I agree with you, because of all the trees, I hardly have to prune it. It has really stayed really nice, has fantastic shape. Where my apple trees, even the heirloom apple trees, you know, some years I have to do a harder prune than others, but the quince has been, the shape is just beautiful. It grows evenly, and just minor pruning, cutting out any dead wood, things like that, but it's been doing really well.
And I will say the flowers on it are just, you want it near a pathway, because when the quince blooms in spring, it is such a beautiful scent. Just as the fruit is highly scented, obviously the flowers are as well. So you want to be able to interact with it. So you don't want to put it in the very back of the garden. But you do want to watch when the fruit does form, because the fruit is very heavy. If you have a fruit that's forming at the end of a branch that maybe has three or four other, you know, other fruits on it, when you're thinning out your fruit, maybe that's the one that you're going to thin, because the quince do become very heavy. They're big fruit.
They are, yes. Yeah, you don't want to break your branch is what you're leading up to.
That's exactly where I'm going.
Yeah. Well, Stephanie, I can't thank you enough for coming back on the show for a second time and talking all about your book. I really, really love it. I think it is exactly the type of book that my listeners would totally get into, because so many of them are growing food and you just take it to a whole nother level. But I really appreciate you coming here and taking the time to share all the information with us. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Teresa. It's been such a pleasure to be here. And also, I love your passion for preserving. And so that really speaks to me as a gardener, and encouraging folks to grow things that they can preserve is fantastic.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Stephanie Bittner of Homestead Design Collective. She really is a wealth of knowledge, but she is also an incredible talent. So if you get a chance to go to the show notes for this episode at livinghomegrown.com/91, you will have links to her website, to the gardens that she's designed, some of the beautiful photography, as well as links to her book, everything that we talked about, and the link to the quince paste recipe. She was generous enough to let us add that into the show notes, so I will have that in the show notes for you. I hope you enjoyed this and it gave you a little bit of inspiration to maybe plant some more unusual edibles in your own garden. So until next time, just try to live a little bit more local, seasonal, and homegrown. Take care.
That's all for this episode of the Living Homegrown Podcast. Visit livinghomegrown.com to download Teresa's free canning resource guide and find more tips on how to live farm fresh without the farm. Be sure to join Teresa Lowe next time on the Living Homegrown Podcast.